Hello, everybody, and a very pleasant good afternoon to you wherever you may be. This is Bruce Ash live. Inside Track co-host Eb Wilkinson is on assignment today, welcoming you to a special edition of Inside Track. We have a great show for you today. Our first guest after the break is Dr. Hani Zubida, and we'll talk about the recent Israeli elections and where events will likely go over the next year or so, as well as something very interesting. It's the fabric of Israel society. It's really, really interesting stuff. After the bottom of the hour break, we'll greet old friend, friend of the show, former Arizona legislator and candidate for CD1 in the last election, Steve Smith, who will talk to us about something he is very immersed in, the American Federation for Children. You'll see the passion that Steve has for kids. I visited the LD2 district meeting earlier this morning. A shout out to Legislative District 2 District Chair Anthony Sizer and his over 170 PCs, as well as the 9 new precinct committeemen who were approved and sworn into office today. Each of these PCs will be eligible to vote, this is really important, for delegates to support Donald Trump in our 2020 presidential caucus process. And to any unregistered Republican who is not a PC now, in order to be eligible for our 2020 presidential caucus, you must be appointed by December 31st, 2019. Now, to find out more information, contact Pima GOP at 321-1492, 321-1492, and start the process. A word of advice, don't wait. In order to ensure the county supervisors will have a chance to approve your application by year end, you know, they're not the most motivated guys around, except for Allie our District 4 man. That's embarrassing. You'll need to complete your simple one-page application to Pima GOP HQ no later than November 20th. That's only 1 month away, so take time now to be a part of history. Hey, as always, thank you so much for supporting our great Inside Track sponsors, Imus Wilkinson Asset Management, Tucson Iron and Metal Surplus, and Corazon Cabinets. These are great local companies you should do business with. Talking about local companies you should be doing business with, Corazon Cabinets is your locally owned source for high-quality kitchen, bath, and office cabinets. Joy, Kelly, and Jennifer can help you design your dream kitchen or bath area. Corazon Kitchens carries J&K, Conestoga, and now Yorktown Cabinets. Come by and visit the showroom soon. See the great displays on what your home will look like with Corazon Cabinets. We are one of the few suppliers of Yorktown Cabinets in Southern Arizona. Call 488-2266 and let them know you heard this ad on Inside Track to receive an additional 5% discount on Corazon's already low wholesale prices. You'll be amazed by the great styles and super low prices at Corazon Cabinets. Friends, before we introduce our very special guests, I'd like to share a few thoughts with you on the Electoral College, which each of the Democrat presidential candidates wants to abolish and fundamentally and radically, I think, change and deconstruct our country. You know, the United States has never been known for plebiscitary politics of the sort envisioned by direct election. We cannot say for sure what forms of presidential ambition will take under direct election. But we know this much. It would be the most unwise, even dangerous, to disconnect our chief executive from the rest of our constitutional and political system without compensating for the loss of the Electoral College's moderating influences. Now look, when you take another peek at the electoral map in 2000 or in 2016 and ask yourself what incentives to compromise would exist under direct election, ask whether voters in less populous states would matter in a national campaign that focused almost exclusively on mass media markets or consider the Florida imbroglio and ask whether we would be better off if such squabbles took place in several dozens of places at once all through the country, as they almost certainly would under a national plebiscite. Ever since the presidency became a popularly elective office, campaigns have been conducted on a state-by-state basis. Most of our political habits, customs, expectations, and opinions about presidential politics are informed and mediated by the principles of federalism. Once election to the presidency is severed from the rest of our constitutional system, new incentives will be created and new lessons taught, none of which will have very much to do with the way elections have been conducted in the past. If the will of the people is seen as an independent force, separate and apart from the rest of our constitutional structure, how shall we constrain a president who invokes a moral mandate of popular will as his reason for ignoring the structure of the office? Something to consider. Friends, stay tuned to Inside Track. We'll be right back after these commercial messages. Welcome back to Inside Track. Our guest for the next segment is Hani Zubida. Dr. Hani Zubida is currently a senior lecturer and the former chair of the political science department at the Max Stern Israel Valley College, and as such, teaches and researches extensively. He is also a well-respected media personality in Israel. He anchors his own TV show and commentates on various television and radio shows, both in Hebrew and in English. Hani completed his MA and PhD in political science at NYU. He has also worked as a statistical analyst and consultant for the largest survey firm in Israel, working with the largest brands in the country, as well as national and local political leaders. Hani is a specialist in immigration, labor migration, identity and general identity, borders and social borders, Israel's electoral system, social mobility in Israel's society, Israel democracy and its socioeconomic and political realms. He has been very active in various social initiatives. Dr. Zubida, welcome to Inside Track. Thanks for joining us.
Thank you. Good morning, Bruce. It's a pleasure.
And you're in town. I know that you did a talk last week in front of a group. I take it that was successful?
Yes. Well, I hope so. We need to ask the people that attended.
Well, I'm sure it was. I've heard good things. Let me get right to it. There is an editorial opinion piece from Haaretz, one of Israel's leading newspapers. The headline of this opinion piece is, "The problem isn't just Bibi. It's the Bibiism with which he has infected Israeli politics." True or false?
Well, to a certain extent, you can say true. To a certain extent, you can say false. If you and I would have a time-traveling machine and go back to the 60s, you and I can write the same article, and instead of writing Bibi and Bibiism, we can write, "The problem is not Ben-Gurion, but it's Ben-Gurionism." When discussing these things and discussing a very long term of a personality, something that cannot happen in the United States because of the term limits, you always have a problem of newspaper reporters, journalists, intellectuals, of the identification between phenomena and the personality. For me, as an academician and intellectual, I would say that this is a bit going off rail, because you have to understand the Israeli society. Somebody was doing it in a very beautiful way. Pnina Lahav resembled the Israeli society to a barrel without its hoops. She said everything exists. You have the bones of the barrel, you have the lid, you have the bottom, everything is there. But as soon as you pour the water in, it falls apart. And she was relating to it in terms of the illegalism in the Israeli society. She wrote this paper almost two decades ago, before the BBH, and it has not changed. It's a society in the making, and we have to understand The problem is not Bibi or Bibiism. The problem is the Israeli society and its ingredients, and it's in our inability to get to a common base that will apply to all.
So what is to stop the Israeli political system from getting these barrels sealed up tight? How would that happen, or is it impossible?
That's an amazing question. In my opinion, it's if we can create some sort of at least few common ideas that will unite all. For instance, let me give you an example and relate maybe to two of countries that people know here, the United States and France. In the United States and France, you have some, well, disagreements, I would call it, but it's not really disagreements. It's those like small arguments about issues, but they're right at the borders of society. In France and in the United States, it is clear one thing. We have the French people and we have the American people. These stand above all. In Israel, this is not the case. In Israel, there is still a contention and a huge discourse about what it is to be an Israeli. What does Israeliness mean? And while we try to somehow find out our own route towards the Israeliness, towards these ideas that will unify us all, you see these problems occur. And in other places, these are the hoops. These are what holds society together. These are what holds the bones together. This is the necessary means to a good structure. And I think in Israel, we don't have them.
Is this because of so much in-migration over a long period of time since the birth of the state in 1948?
Yeah, one of the issues. You're definitely right. Let me give you another great example. You have people that came from Russia before the formation of the state, during the 20s, 30s, 40s, and they're called the waves of immigration, wave number one, wave number two, wave number three. Now, another bunch of people immigrated to Israel during the 70s, between 1970 and 76. They came to Israel after there was a small crack in the walls of the former Soviet Union. And then after the glasnost and the perestroika, when everything fell apart, you had a huge wave of immigration coming during the 90s. Now, if you look at them, they all have about the same ingredients of society and composition. But the first one are called pioneers. The second one are called the good Russian immigration. And the third one is called the Russian immigration. Why is that? Because I think in the Israeli society, even when you have people coming from the same place, but different times in history and different socialization, you see people are rushing into creating those segregations between people. And I'm not even talking about the Jews that came from Ethiopia, Jews that came from Arab countries, those who are not Jews and came to Israel under the law of return. All these create an issue of collectiveness. And we have not discussed even the Jews that are residing in the United States, which are half of the Jewish nation. And as you know, the Israeli state is not the state of the people who reside in Israel. It's the state of all the Jews.
So, honey, I think there's somewhere between 6.5 and 7 million Israeli citizens these days. How many of those millions actually split their time between the United States and Israel? About, do you know?
Well, the numbers really, you know, you have different estimations. I would estimate any number between 800,000 and 1.5 million, talking about like people who actually have a focus of life in the United States, that would be the number. Some would say that includes Canada as well.
Okay.
And that's a huge number.
So in the United States, we have the United States Constitution, which seems to hold maybe sometimes imperfectly, but it seems to hold our laws and sort of a framework together. In Israel, there is no such thing as a constitution as it's been formatted here in this country. But what is it in? Are you talking about a legal framework, or are you talking about a social and legal framework kind of combined that creates the hoops, if you will?
Yes, it's the combination. You're definitely right. Because if you add to them to your equation of the Constitution and the legal rights, and you add the Supreme Court as a branch that has the ability to oversee the executive and the legislative, and you have the separation of power, which you don't have in Israel. Don't forget, the Knesset, which is the legislator, is controlled by the government, who is the executive branch, and the Supreme Court doesn't have any constitution to lay on for some sort of, I don't know, critique, another opinion, and so on and so forth. In Israel, you have the basic laws, which are not enough as a format. And let me add to that, one of the basic issues in Israel is state and religion. And this is a question that stands at the core of the determination of the nation and of the composition of the nation. Mm-hmm. If we go for a constitution, then the question is, what do we do? Do we separate between state and religion? Because in any other scenario, you have to agree or accept the notion that Israel is the state of the Jewish people. That includes people that are not resident or citizens of Israel and have the ability to come and naturalize immediately on that base, which is now, if we talk about the highest concentration of Jews in the world, is the United States. Now, that separates the Arabs. In case you go for constitution and you kind of like change the definition of Israel to the state of all its citizens, and that includes all the Arab citizens of Israel, then the question is, what if? And I think that's another discourse that somehow hides in the shadows, but always there, and people are afraid to touch it.
So just for our listeners, information, myself as an American Jew, I have the ability to claim dual citizenship if I so decide. Yes. And that oftentimes, or not oftentimes, but that has happened in many, many cases where people decide to do that. That's something that is different than here in this country. But the whole notion of, in the United States, e pluribus unum, out of many, one, can that ever exist in Israel, given the all of the different people who've come to Israel to live there and work, or is there a possibility that same sort of a concept could work or would work there?
It's a question, but then you know what it means. It means nullifying the idea of a Jewish state.
Right.
That means that it is also important to say, you, Bruce, as a Jew, have the ability to enter the state of Israel and immediately on entry point to declare that you desire to be a citizen of Israel. And according to the basic laws of the state of Israel, the state is mandated to issue you the citizenship on the spot. Right. No questions asked. This is, if you think about it in terms of the United States and people who think about the process in the United States, entering, applying, getting permanent residency, and then applying for citizenship, the process can take about 10 years. And in Israel, it takes less than an hour. Now, the question is, what will this change do? How will that, and let me remind our listeners, this is a crucial point in Israel, because most of the people who reside in Israel view the state of Israel as a Jewish state as their number one priority, regardless of everything else that surrounds this question. So the notion of constitution, separation of powers, having a Supreme Court that has a constitution to lean on to somehow overlook the other branches, it is way more complicated than the regular scenario. And that doesn't really work in the Israeli case.
So
the hoops are so loose.
So before we leave this topic and get a little bit more into the outcome of the election, in terms of the hoops again, Israel then fundamentally is different from the United States in that it is a Jewish state, And yes. But at the same time, non-Jews as well as Arabs are welcome and have, and particularly Arabs have status in the government and in society and in business and culture and so on. That's something that a lot of, that it's lost on a lot of people. The Arabs who live in Israel probably have, again, I don't want to give my opinion, but I'm asking you, do Israeli Arabs have greater rights or less rights living in Israel than they would living in, say, their native country, whether it be Syria or Iraq or Jordan or wherever it is that they've emigrated from?
Well, that's a complicated question, because the question is, who do you compare the Arabs who live in Israel to? If you're an Arab living in Israel, you compare them to the Jews. And if you compare them to the Jews, they're not equal. If you compare the Arabs, and that depends which type of Arabs, because you have Christian Arabs, you have Muslim Arabs, you have Shiite, you have Sunnite, you have Sufi. It varies across the Middle East, and these differentiations are crucial as you go into Arab countries. We all know the case of the Yazidis in Iraq, the Christian minority that was persecuted. They were tortured, rape, and so on and so forth. There are issues there, issues of civil rights, issues of LGBTQ rights, issues of women's rights, issues of minorities' rights. And we know that the Middle East today is boiling up to a point of explosion. And the question is, the Arabs, when they see themselves and they compare themselves to the Jews in Israel. Now, the situation is better than other places. But the question, can it be better in Israel? And this is the question that is right now being a question of contention in the Israeli society due to the violence within the Arab society. Shootings, killings, weapon that is very common in Arab villages and cities. And now the Arabs are demanding the state to step into this case and change the situation. But I think there was a huge change due to the election outcome and the pre-election campaign, when the head of the Arab United Party said, we are now willing to take part in Israeli government. And that was the first time it was ever said. So I would say the situation is much better. It can improve. And it depends on the Israeli political leadership to take the steps to change it.
The point you just made is so critical, because there was quite a turnout amongst Arab voters in the most recent Israeli election, correct?
Yeah. Between April and September, the change in the turnout was more than 11 points. And this is huge.
Sure.
It is, in terms of electoral participation, this is like a tectonic shift. It's an earthquake.
And do you think that it was the Arab vote in this most recent election that may have turned the tide against Netanyahu's outright re-election and his party maintaining their coalition majority?
It was one of the things that happened. The other thing that happened was the shift to Lieberman. There was a huge shift towards the Lieberman, the Israel Beitenu party. Lieberman was considered to be, saying that now in hindsight might sound stupid to some people, but he's considered to be a rightist, and he's not. He's now the only obstacle between a narrow right government and Netanyahu. Lieberman, he's the guy. And he said, after the latest holiday interview he gave to Ma'ariv, where he lashed at Netanyahu and other major personas in the Likud, it seems that there is no way of mending this fence. On the other hand, I think that there was a lot of shifts in the partisan system. The alt-right that everybody was looking up to, Ayelet Shaked, Naftali Bennett, people thought that they would somehow rally 10, 11, 12 seats in the parliament. They came up with 7 or 8, which is a huge failure, especially if you take into account that during April they didn't cross the threshold of the electoral system and were kicked out of the parliament. And now when they united all their powers together, expecting 11, 12 seats, they barely got 7 or 8, while she was the Minister of Justice and Ayelet Shaked and Naftali Bennett was the Minister of Education, which is a complete failure to the alt-right. I think the Israeli voter has said, we do not want neither a right system or a left system. We want a centric system. And this is where everybody is heading to. But the only obstacle is Netanyahu and the hearing and all the allegations. In case Netanyahu will come out clear of all the allegations, this can be constituted in a day, a centric coalition. In case Netanyahu will have to go to trial, there would be a huge issue and somebody will have to replace him. And this is right now the main issue or the main obstacle in front of a centric coalition. So it's not just the Arab, it's a compilation of things. But in a general sense, Netanyahu has suffered a major loss, a personal major loss, because he threw all his chips on these elections and he lost again.
We have just a minute to remain before we have to end this, honey. So what kind of a time frame do you think the Israelis are looking at in order to have some resolution? Because the government is sort of in a crisis position, it seems to me, not having a clear leadership at this time. How long is this going to take to get sorted out?
Unfortunately, I don't think it will be sorted out. I think we'll go for a third set of election in, at the maximum, a year. And I do not see a solution, because the problem, Bruce, is not the actual ability to somehow work out a coalition. The problem is that the Israeli voter is split right down the middle. And our system, which is different from the United States, because it is a parliamentary system with proportional representation and not majority plurality, we have a very fragmented system. And the Israeli voters are showing fragmentations. And this goes back again to the question we discussed, the question of core ideas, which are common to all. And I think we lack them in the Israeli society.
Well, you know, the more we're different, honey, the more perhaps we're alike. You know, we are split probably in a similar fashion here in the United States, different factions and so on. But we certainly are split the same way. I appreciate the fact that the United States isn't the only country to be facing these sorts of issues, left or right, centrist. And I thank you very, very much for agreeing to come on to the show. I know you don't get to Tucson all that often, but I hope we can call upon you, perhaps as things get cleared up in Israel, to get your take on the election and on Israel society. I think really what you've talked about on Israel society is maybe even more important than the election. So thanks very much for that. And thanks for being a guest today.
Welcome back to Inside Track. This is Bruce. My memory failed me in the last segment, actually in the initial segment where I was talking about county supervisors. Steve Christie, I've only known the guy for 25 years, and I had sort of a brain cramp, I guess. But I am pleased to be a friend of Steve Smith, who's our next guest. Steve served in our Arizona legislature. Steve, like our president, believes in delivering on promises made, and he always did that when he served in our state government. Steve is a former Republican member of the Arizona Senate, representing District 11 from 2015 to 2019. He previously represented the 11th District in the House from 2013 to 15, and District 23 in the Senate from 2011 to 2013. He is one of the most honorable men I've ever worked with in politics. Think about this as Steve discusses school choice and the American Federation for Children, which he represents. And this is directly from the American Federation. School choice is about a fundamental right for parents to have access to the educational environment that serves their children best. Steve, welcome to the show. You've been a champion for many causes. How did you come to be associated with the American Federation for Children?
Well, first, thank you, Bruce, and thanks for having me on, and thanks for all the work that you've done, my friend. It's an honor to be with you again. And American Federation for Children, so a lot of the education policy that we worked on in the Senate for years is kind of in a weird kind of way what we're working on now at American Federation for Children. AFC, as it's called, is a national organization. The current U.S. Secretary of Education, Betsy DeVos, was our previous chairman. And so Arizona is considered by many as the leader in the nation in school choice, this whole thing called school choice. And so, yes, after my term in the Senate ended in January of this year, I came on, and I'm their director now for all of Arizona. And our job, quite simply, is to continue to advocate for parents to be able for them to be able to pick the school that they want best for their kid and their education model that's best for them, and of course try to have matching policy and things like that. And so, but what I always tell people is because people always say, I think I know what school choice is. I think I support school choice. It's one of those issues I have always heard about, but I don't even know if I really truly understand what it is. And what you just read, Bruce, is perfect. And that's certainly our definition and what we think. But school choice is, frankly, letting parents decide what is the best education model for their kid. Boy, what a novel concept, right? You know, so whether that's a public school, private school, online, homeschool, whatever it is, whatever the parent thinks is best, we want to encourage that and promote that. And that's what we do.
Mm-hmm. Let's go from the abstract to the real emphasis about this question. Jordan Visser lives in Arizona. And let me just read a paragraph from his story on the American Federation website. I have cerebral palsy and autism. When I was 5 years old and ready to go to kindergarten, the public school district did not want my mom to enroll me. They told my mom I shouldn't be in school and that I needed to be in a life skills course. My mom says she knew they were pushing her towards sending me to live my life in an institution. My mom searched and searched for ways to help me. She found out the state had a new program called the Empowerment Scholarship Account, ESA, and it changed everything for us. I was one of the very first students to use ESAs when it started in 2011. And through the years, my mom has been able to help me so much. Now, for all of the people on the left who talk about ESAs and school choice as being an aid to the rich to get into these private schools, Tony programs. Jordan Visser, there has to be thousands of Jordan Vissers here in Arizona and hundreds of thousands of Jordans all across America. This is the essence of what school choice and parents being able to advocate for their kids is all about, isn't it?
You know, Bruce, you're 100% right. And Jordan's phenomenal, and to your point too, there's thousands more like him. You know, when I was on the Senate Education Committee, another similar story that'll highlight what you just said, and could it kind of answer your question too about, hey, are these programs just for rich kids? Driving 5-6 hours one direction, a family came up from the Navajo Nation, and they said, and this young man got up there and he spoke and he says, I was ready to be the next statistic. I was ready to drop out of school. My mom found this ESA program, Empowerment Scholarship Account program, and basically just allowed her to send me to a better school that fit me better, because the schools on the Navajo Nation were failing schools, the public schools. Allowed to go to a great private school up there, and he says, I'm the first in my family to graduate, first in my family to go to college. And to your point, and if you knew anything about this kid's background and the life of difficulty they have living on the Navajo Nation with limited resources, to say the least, we hear stories like this every single day. And that's why AFC, American Federation for Children, where I'm at now, our motto, so to speak, is we help especially low-income and disadvantaged students across the country. So we want to make sure that the people that would normally never be able to get the type of education that they're getting, that they truly get it. Because there's one fastest way out of poverty or a bad situation, and that's a great education. And so, yes, you're 100% right. I can't tell you the vast amount of people that we see, that we talk to, that we deal with, that we hear from. These are families that would never typically be able to afford this education. And because of these programs we've had in Arizona, the ESA program we enacted in 2001, as you mentioned in Jordan's little write up there, multiple states all over the country have since followed suit and copied Arizona's lead. And once again, we're setting the bar for the rest of the nation.
So why the resistance to this? Why the resistance to really representing moms and dads who want the best for their kids, do you think?
Well, it's education is like any other business. The more customers you have, the more money you're going to make. So in Arizona, there are 1.2 million K-12 students across the whole state of Arizona. And just imagine for a second that every kid just has a big dollar sign over their head. Because when you add up state funding, local funding, your property taxes, federal funding, and put them all together, it's about, I think now with the last budget, we're up to about $12,000 a student average. So every kid has a $12,000 price tag over your head. Well, the more kids that go to your school, right, the more buckets of money you're going to keep collecting if you're that school. More kids, more money. Well, if you lose kids, less money. So the answer to your question is why the resistance. There's many on the left. There's many of the union mindset that they want to keep the monopoly in the public schools. So if there's less competition out there, well, then all the kids got to keep coming to my school, which will keep filling my union coffers, which will keep allowing me to elect the people that I might want to elect. Well, now, AFC is a nonpartisan, you know, organization. We just care about kids and families. But the fact of the matter is, when you start giving families choices now, hey, you know, you don't have to go to the school that your zip code says you need to go to. You can go to whatever school you want. And when families start exercising choice, you know, that good old thing called American competition, right? The good old thing called capitalism,
free markets,
where you exercise where you want to do. Well, a lot of the monopoly schools might say, well, I'm losing kids. Well, guess what? Parents vote with their feet and with their wallets. If you have a good product at whatever school you are, they're going to stay. If they think they can get a better product, better education somewhere else, they're going to go. They're going to be a consumer like they are in every other aspect of their life.
You bet.
But the people in the education world, many of them who are tied to the union dollars, don't want to see kids leaving the monopoly. They want them there, whether it's a failing school or not.
Charles is called into the show. Charles is a friend of the show. Charles, you have a question for Steve Smith.
That would make a great bumper sticker. Vote with your wallet.
So, you bet.
Mr. Smith, I have a defining question that I like to ask people that are in political office, and that is, according to Arizona's Constitution, what is the stated purpose of government in Arizona?
Well, it's uphold the Constitution and protect the people.
Yep. In essence, that's correct. It's Article 2, Section 2. And I applaud people who actually grasp that. Thank you for the direct answer.
Yeah, there was really no question in my mind that Steve was going to get that question right. Charles has asked that of elected officials, former elected officials, and aspiring elected officials for years. And actually, what you're doing now in your work with the American Federation, Steve, appears to be really right in line with what you were doing as a member of the state legislature. You're doing the same exact thing.
Well, in some respects, yes, you're 100% right in that the policy we fought for, we want to just keep upholding. But see, now, Bruce, it's so much, you're so much closer to it now, because certainly as a senator, you hear from constituents all over and you try to help them when they say, hey, I have a question, I have an issue, I have a problem. But now in my role at AFC, literally every day, I'm communicating with new parents. And I would say, it's hard to know, but I would say based on my conversations, 80% of them, I would say folks would consider minority and or low income. The overwhelming majority of people that I come in contact with that want these programs typically will have representation in the House or the Senate that hate these programs. And when you look at the part of states where they come from, if you look up who their elected officials are, they're typically Democrats. And unfortunately, in Arizona, every Democrat has voted against these issues that we care about. Now, we've done national polling, just not in Arizona, but across the nation. Would you believe the number one polling demographic across the country who support this whole notion of school choice is Hispanics, 73%. White and black right behind us, 68%. The majority of every demographic supports school choice. Even Democrat voters, 56%. Millennials, independents, you name them, they all support this idea of school choice. The people support it. But you know who does not largely support it? Democrat lawmakers. Why? So why would Democrat voters support it, but not Democrat lawmakers? Well, because the people understand, well, heck yeah, it's my kid. It's my money. It's my tax money. I should be able to say where it goes. So Democrats understand that too. But Democrat lawmakers, by and large, are beholden to the unions. They get paid by the unions. The Democratic voters don't. So the people support this thing called school choice. It's largely Democrat lawmakers that don't. And that's a big, big, big disservice to their own constituents.
One of our great educators who oftentimes calls into the show, Mark, is on the line for a question or a comment. Mark, go ahead.
Yes, and before I get into that, I wanted to tell you that I went back to Tucson Iron and Metal a couple, 3 weeks ago or so, and I met Jamie Kipper and Gladys Caballero and some other people there. Anyway, went across the street to see that musical instrument that was made out of the scrap, metal. That was quite a
good for you.
Giant harp looking thing. Anyway, I got costing just under $40. I got at least $240 worth of stuff that I wish I had gotten more because I still need some more stuff. I got to get back there.
I think we just made a new commercial for Tucson Iron. Do you have a question or comment for Steve Smith?
Yes, I do. And Steve Smith, I'm not sure exactly what you're doing, but if you're deep into education, one of the most successful parts of education that we have seen here in Arizona is the career technical education aspect of it. And I'm also certified as a engineering science teacher in that realm, as well as I do physics and STEM kind of stuff. And I was educated partially in Bavaria, Germany, as well as, of course, in the United States. And I think a very good system would be kind of like a hybrid of the two systems. When I was when I went to Ansbach, the Plattengymnasium in Ansbach, Bayern, and anyway, they have it's like a CTE program for everybody, and then you can choose your various little niche paths along the way. And that's what we really need here, is more something like that.
Steve, what do you think about that?
Yeah, you're 100% right. And not only are you right, but that's exactly what we've been doing. I know when I was in the Senate, we made it a priority every year to fully fund our career and tech education, CTE. And we did it every year. And the reason that was important, of course, was because what you just highlighted. Then I took it a step further. I was the chairman of the Commerce Committee and the Military Committee in the Senate. So everything that had to deal with our economy, jobs, would come through my committee. And about a year and a half ago, 2 years ago, I introduced a bill to get more workers trained and into vocational stuff, electricians, plumbers, pipe fitters, welders, you name it. And I would bring in company after company after company. I started an early release program from prison for nonviolent, mainly drug offenders. I'd bring them out early, and I'd put them in a rehabilitation program, and I would bring the vocational business owners to them, the largest electricians companies in the state, plumbing companies, and they would take these soon-to-be-released prisoners, train them, and get them in the workforce. But it wasn't just prisoners. It was everybody, because in about 10 years, half of the country's electricians will be retired. You know why? Mm-hmm. Because nowadays everybody says everybody's got to go to college. Well, no, they don't.
Yeah. Nope, they don't.
Who says everybody's got to go to college? College is good, but it's not for everybody. And so, all right, a generation ago, a lot of people, most people, didn't go to college. And they're the ones that would go into auto repair and again, some of the trades that we know and talk about, the apprenticeship programs. Well, so few people are doing those nowadays. Well, I made a big push a couple years ago in the Senate here to change all that. So I got a federal grant to allow business owners, mom and shop, plumbing, electrician, welding shops, to be able to bring in new people, train them through a federal grant that we had, so it didn't cost the business owner any money, but it was able to flesh them out, get them trained, and get them working. Our housing industry is front and center in the example. Our housing industry says, I can't hire people fast enough.
I need carpenters, welders, you know, I need everybody. I need electricians. I need everybody. And it's a such shortage. And so the big push that I've been doing the last few years is getting that in track. And the legislation we were able to sign, that Governor Ducey was able to pass and sign into law, is helping do just that. I know that's a really long answer, but you're 100% right. Vocational studies are massively important, and we need a lot more people doing them.
Steve and Mark, we're going to have to leave it right there. We're up against the end of the hour. Steve, thank you so much for being a guest today. We're going to have you on again soon. We need to hear more about this. And friends, as we conclude our show today, take your mail-in ballot for Ed Ackerley, as well as the three nominees from the Republican Party for city council. Vote for them. Vote no on Sanctuary City, and continue to support all of our great Inside Track partners, Imus Wilkinson Asset Management, Corazon Cabinets, Tucson Iron and Metal Surplus. These are great locally owned and family-run businesses you should do business with. Until next week for Inside Track, this is Bruce Ash, and I am wishing for all of us a great Arizona win tonight against the University of Southern California, and wishing all of you a very pleasant good afternoon.